20 years ago, Sayadaw Upandita was here teaching a small group of teachers and senior students. And he, at one point, had a group interview and asked of the 37 bodhipakyas, which are lists of various lists that you've been hearing about, like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Faculties, the Five Powers, and, you know, all these numbers and lists, which are the most important? And everyone gave their answers, and the overall most important one was and is the Satipatthana Sutta, that is the mindfulness of the four foundations, body, feelings, mind, and dhammas, all mind experience. Why? Because everything else is contained in them. All the other bodhipakyas are contained within these four foundations of mindfulness. Last week, I began a series of the four foundations with Dhamma Ruan chanting the opening part that introduces the essence of his own discovery or rediscovery, what Buddhas do when the Dhamma is disappeared in the human realm, come back and through their own diligent self-inner work, rediscover what is true, the Dhamma, and present it. And so the Satipatthana Sutta and the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, he taught all over northeast and northwest India, as far as the area of Delhi. And eventually, these teachings spread all over Asia, as far east as Japan and the Koreas, China, and as far south as Indonesia and Sri Lanka, and as far west as Afghanistan, Persia, probably even further than that, and as far north as Siberia. I introduced the teachings of this being the direct path, which is what Dhamma Ruan chanted for us. The mindfulness of body, including the breathing we observe and often use as an anchor to initially ground our attention in the moment. Awareness of postures. We primarily use sitting, walking. We teach standing and even encourage lying, you know, when you're lying in bed or taking a rest, or for those who can only lie in practice. And eventually, that'll be the only posture any of us can do. So it's a good one to practice. Mindfulness of activities is all the movements throughout the day. I often advocate choosing a touchstone, that is one activity that we do with extra care and mindfulness. It might be stepping, you know, there's lots of steps around here, or turning, every time you make a turn in any direction, or reaching for our jacket, our hat, our spoon, our coat. And in that impulse moment, just prior to the activity, to be mindful of that volitional moment that you're about to reach, that intention, and then feel all the qualities of the experience of reaching from within the reaching experience, from within the turning or the stepping. And eventually, there's an overflow, of course, of that into all of our activities. Anatomical parts of the body is another of the mindfulness of the body practices that taught in some traditions. They just go through the body, picking various organs of the body and skin, hair, teeth, nails, and whatnot. Really focus on them and see them as they are, as their composite nature, separate from how we conceptualize them as I or you, as self, so forth. Body also includes, and we emphasize this one a lot, the dhatus, or elements, the elemental nature. In the archaic language of fire, water, earth, and air, but the experience, of course, that the immediate felt experience of heat, of temperature and texture and motion and cohesion, fluidity. That's how we know what the body is. And learning to feel, experience the body as the body from within the body with mindfulness, not from a separate conceptual or discursive view. And even in that time of the Buddha, where it was quite open, and in some parts of Asia still is, the meditation on the decaying corpses. Usually didn't have to go walk very far, you know, for a cemetery, and just the corpses out in the open. In many parts of Asia today, you can find this. We use a lot of the posture for our investigation, our anchors, breathing, activities, and the elemental nature for our body awareness. The second one being feelings. As I mentioned, every moment of experience, there's a feeling tone, either physically, mentally, through any of the sense doors. What we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and emote or think. There's a pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral tone to that. We find that in the very tangible, physical, worldly experience that we have, and also in more supramundane practice, subtle states of consciousness. We find what's called the unworldly, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings. The mind being the third foundation of mindfulness, where we first learn to observe the mind as it might be colored by lust, desire, distraction, delusion, or their opposites, contentment, metta, wisdom, and focus, or collectedness of mind. And then we experience in deeper, more subtle levels of practice, the mind that is grown great, or when it narrows, becomes contracted. And we notice it when it's either surpassable or unsurpassable in its sense of spaciousness, openness, and so forth. It goes on, more and more subtle states of mind, until we actually can see the stream of mind in the moment, in its swiftly flowing nature, arising and passing, just the knowing mind, awareness itself, turned on itself. The mind knowing itself as it's arising, passing away. The Dhammas, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, one way of describing it is it's the combination of all the other three. The Buddha particularly mentioned certain groups, such as the hindrances, to notice their nature, their characteristic, their effect on the mind, because of their ability to inhibit the growth of calm and insight. And he also listed the what's called the aggregates of our being, that it is the composite nature, the physical form as it's flowing, arising and passing, the feeling tone, again here, perception, that remembers or marks objects of experience, all volitional states, mental states, and consciousness. He listed them, and he listed all of these because each time we investigate, we see that there's just process happening. And they're not happening to anyone. They're not happening from anyone. They're just conditions. They're just natural law. And within this, we begin to see their unique and universal natures. So these mental states and sense spheres is another one. That is, we come to know, as I explained last week in talking about the extension of consciousness of the Botswana tracker, Lapata, or a Polynesian navigator like Mao Pialug, in which the sense field of sight or sound or scent or taste or touch isn't something that's experienced out there anywhere. It's all within the mind. So everything, all experience is just brought right here. And in that way, one is one with their environment. And for the navigator, it becomes a map of where they are, where they're going. And likewise with the tracker. The desert is same as in an ocean. And there's signs to read in the stars, in the colors, and in the direction of animal movement, and air currents, and scent and taste, and so forth. So all these practices start to remove a sense of fragmentation and instead begin to unify the sense of ourselves, of mind and body, and ourselves with other beings, ourselves with all of life, all living. It becomes this sense of interconnectedness. The awakening factors, he mentioned those also, seven factors of awakening, like mindfulness, and then three energizing forces, investigation, energy, joy, or joyous interest, balanced by three tranquilizing factors, calm, concentration, equanimity. So, you know, these lists are really quite amazing, how they lift the mind or tranquilize the mind as necessary, and they're not lists. They are who we are. They are what's being developed as we do this practice. The Noble Truths, of course, are a part of this list. The Four Noble Truths, where we really learn dukkha for ourselves. We're not separate. Who we are, the process of our being, the stream of this mind and body itself inherently has the quality of this First Noble Truth, of dukkha. Why? Because there's nothing about it that's lasting that we can grab onto, that we can hang on to for any sense of security, any sense of self, any sense of gratification, ultimate gratification or satisfaction. It's just process. And we, as I'll talk about a little more later, we have to go through it, and going through it is really empowering, really liberating, and really takes us to a place of a non-dependent joy, a non-dependent happiness that is not dependent on rearranging our environment and changing people or things outside of ourselves. And now I'd like to ask Dhamma Ruan to chant what's known as the definition. I'll give you an English reading so you know what he's chanting. This moves along from the introduction last week. What are the four? Here, bhikkhus, in regard to the body, a meditator abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. Now, when the Buddha spoke of world, he used the word loka. And the world he's talking about isn't outside. It's our own internal psychological experience. So So even how we experience the outside world, it's still our inner world. The world is our own mind, heart. In regard to feelings, he or she, the meditator, abides contemplating feelings, diligent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires, discontent in regard to the world. In regard to the mind, she abides contemplating the mind, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. In regard to dhammas, she abides contemplating dhammas, diligent, clearly knowing, and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa katame cattaro ida bhikkave bhikkhu kāye kāyānupassī viharati ātāpi sampajāno satimā vinīya loke Abhinja domanasang Vedanasu Vedananupassi viharati Atapi sampajano Satima vineya loke Abhinja domanasang Chitte chittanupassi viharati Atapi sampajano Satima vineya loke abhinja domanassam Dhammesu dhammanupassi viharati Atapi sampajano Satima vineya loke abhinja domanassam
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's very powerful to hear Dhamma in its own element, spoken in its own language, a language that has held and protected and been carried by, through the discipline of the ordained Sangha and the realization of nuns, monks, lay women, and lay men for 2,500 years. Consider that for the first 300 years, it was only an oral tradition. And much emphasis was placed on accuracy and memory. Many of the disciples of the Buddha, the senior disciples, had the fantastic powers of memorization. So they impacted it in their consciousness and it's the way it's been really passed down and still is, even though in Sri Lanka, some 300 years after the Buddha's passing into Parinibbana, they began also writing down, first on palm leaf script. So explains then what the four are and how to abide in knowing each of them. So the clearly knowing and the diligence references are courage. Diligence could be said to be close to virya, which is courageous energy. It keeps us going, a balanced energy, clearly knowing. That is the intuitive knowing, free from the conceptualization of experience. So that's how we develop an awareness that eventually lets go of the form and the conceptualization, proliferation process that's so conditioned to immediately name something, describe it, to have a discursive relationship to it. The aim of the satipatthanas, mindfulness of body, feelings, mind, and dhammas, is to go to show directly the reality of moment-to-moment experience. As I mentioned this morning, the paramita, which distinguishes what's felt immediate experience, that is, it can be known by the mind, and what's concept, just a description, just the interpretation or an analysis of experience. The aim of the satipatthana practice is to go right into things as they really are, to know both the unique and universal nature of body, feelings, mind, and dhammas. As an example, the unique is knowing, for example, in the arm when we feel pain of some sort, we let the awareness soften around or go through the resistance to the pain and to feel from within the experience of the pain pressure, heat, tightness, pinpricks, pulling, exactly what's happening. That's its unique nature. Its universal nature is that it's not static. It's not just one continuous, unchanging pain. It's in constant process. As soon as you feel that pinprick here, that seems to pass away, and you feel pulling here, you feel aching there, you feel itching somewhere else. And later on, in those moments, those lovely moments when the body is pain-free, you know, the body can feel really porous, almost as if you can stick your hand through it. Sensations are so subtle then, and so light. Still, we're seeing unique nature, you know, and that would be the element, earth element, for example, of real subtle softness rather than heaviness. Our very neutral temperature. You feel neither heat nor cold, something real in between. Or where the air element is balanced, where neither tension nor intense vibration, very, very subtle vibrations. You know, we see the extremes, we see the balance. Likewise, in the mind, a unique, immediate, non-conceptual experience of mental phenomena is knowing the contracting nature of miserliness or greed or clinging, and then the liberating, suddenly spacious, energetic quality of generosity. Another mind state, another moment, another consciousness. The powerful separating force of anger, ill will, hatred, judgment, and the incredibly soothing sense of connection, interconnection, oneness that metta provides, that sense of oneness with all beings, with all of life. That's the unique nature. Each mental state has a texture, has a quality of it that we can experience directly, not through thought, to know it in the moment as it is. And its universal nature, likewise with the body, is its continuous change. What seems like a solid block of tightness and tension in a frustrating state of discomfort, you know, with patience, with finding a center of our awareness that can begin to explore all around that blocked feeling, that contracted feeling, start to see that it actually has little perforations, you know, like the wind can get through it, or, you know, like an X-ray can see through it. And pretty soon it starts to break down as a block and falls away, it dissolves. The aim of the Satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness, is to see that all of these domains of experience, body, feelings, mind, and dhammas, all experience of mind, are always changing. None of them can provide any lasting stability. So there's an insecurity to them all. That's the dukkha nature. To see that is a joyful experience. To go into our pain, to open to our pain, once we let go of the resistance, is a very grounding experience. You have to be in the moment. If we're resisting it or judging it or making a story around it, it's a buffer to knowing it, to feeling it from within. But if we're feeling it from within, it may indeed be unpleasant, but that presence, the power of presence, in fact, one of the definitions of sati, mindfulness, is presence. Presence of awareness, the presence of mindfulness, or attending with mindfulness. So that attending just opens up, keeps us grounded in the moment, but opens up to what's real. Dukkha is real. And to feel what's real while in the present moment is okay. It may not feel good, but it's true. It may be unpleasant, but feeling it is good. Knowing it, understanding it is good. In the next part of the Satipatthana Sutta, it's a refrain that continues. I'm just going to read one of them in regard to the body. It follows also feelings, mind, and dhammas, mind experience. The English translation, in this way, in regard to the body, one abides contemplating the body internally, or abides contemplating the body externally, or abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. One abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body, or abides contemplating the nature of passing away in the body. Or she abides contemplating the nature of both arising and passing away in the body. Mindfulness that there is a body is established in her to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous or sustained mindfulness. And she abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is how, in regard to the body, she abides contemplating the body.
Ityanjattam va kai kayanupassi viharati. Bahidda va kai kayanupassi viharati. Ajjatte bahidda va kai kayanupassi viharati. Samudaya dhammanupassi va kayasmin viharati. Vaya dhammanupassi va kāyasmiṃ viharati samudaya vaya dhammānupassīvā kāyasmiṃ viharati atti kāyoti vāpanassa satipacchu paṭṭitā hoti yāvadeva ñāna mattāya patissati mattāya Anissito ca viharati na ca kinci loke upadiyati. Evam piko bhikkave bhikkhu kaye kayanupassi viharati.
sadhu, sadhu. These teachings are directly from the suttas, the oldest texts of the Buddha's teachings. Later on, the commentaries give differing views, which is healthy, on what is meant, for example, by contemplating the body internally or externally, or both internally and externally. And the one that I favor the most is, since we're talking here about insight, this non-conceptual, pre-verbal awareness that knows the body as it really is, by direct inference, we know that all other bodies, kaya, of any being, of any object, is also composite in this way. If we know our own body internally, we know all bodies externally as well. And we know both internally and externally. We have a deep understanding of all of life. Nothing is separate. Nothing is out there. There's not a body out there that's different than this one. Our own wisdom teaches us the nature, the elemental nature, of this streaming flow of elements. And we know immediately that's the same for all others. The nature of arising, contemplating the nature of the arisings. You know, when we feel in the body the arising element of heat, vibration, pressure, coolness, hardness, softness, smoothness, so forth. And then the passing away. And then the both arising and passing away. You hear in one of the very earliest, most profound, perhaps certainly one of the most important of all the Buddha's teachings, suttas, he's already suggesting the liberating power of insight. Because as we begin to instinctually, intuitively have insight into this nature of arising and passing, not through thought, not through any mental discursive analysis, but the direct and immediate experience, as I mentioned before, it sometimes is, it is shattering, you know, to the sense of solid sense of a separate self. It's that first kind of shattering. We want to run back and cling on to those concepts for security, for safety. And then, you know, a little more we practice, a little more we open up and let go and see again, taste again, immediately, intuitively, this arising nature, this passing nature, this arising and passing nature. It is actually later on described as one of the most significant of all the early stages of insight, and that is because in its most mature form, one experiences such a depth of Dhamma, of the truth, that there's no turning back. There's no being led astray. Even if you stop practice, at some point, your karma will bring you back to the path. You've seen too much to be too deluded. Again, this is a poem by Mary Oliver called The Journey. One day, you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles, "Mend my life," each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, in a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. In the beginning, there's all these voices, most of them our own, you know, saying, don't go any further, it's too scary. How much do you have to give up? You know, or other voices, you know, friends, what do you do at that strange place you go to in Massachusetts? And, you know, what do you do when you go in your room and sit like that all the time? And but you have to let go, you know. At some point, those voices don't have the power, whether they're from within or without. You have to go, and you keep taking those steps, and you go through new portals, because it's very rare in life that an opportunity opens, and the teachings, liberation teachings of wisdom, are presented, and more rare that we hear them, more rare that we understand them, more rare that we're inspired to put them into practice, and more rare to come and do the practice, and most rare to sustain the practice to completion. Now, there's a couple of ways to relate to the Four Foundations as a progression. You know, we spend a lot of time and have over the last 20, 25 years emphasizing breath and body a lot in the beginning, because it's an obviously available, tangible object to ground our attention on, to use as an anchor, and to stay with it. As the mind grows more subtle and quiet, we move on to all the mental phenomena. Feelings are mental phenomena. Whether it's a pleasant or unpleasant feeling in the body, or with regard to emotions, thoughts, sights, sounds, whatever, feeling is a mental phenomena. And it is subtle. At first, you know, real painful feeling, not so subtle. But it grows into greater and greater subtlety, particularly when we enter that realm of very refined Dhamma energy, refined Dhamma pleasures, called like piti, rapture, joy, are a deep sense of calm abiding, the body feeling completely relaxed, at one with itself and the mind and everything, a spiritual happiness. An equanimity, which isn't strong in either, has neither pain or pleasure, and yet has the subtlest sense of sweetness for that perfect balance. So, and then the mind, of course, in its initial more gross states where we experience the textures and characteristics and nature of anger, you know, the heat of jealousy and envy and so forth. But they too, you know, silence, become more silent, become more transformed, and we enter more subtle mental states and feel the stream of mind at its most peaceful, at its most silent place. And then on to the subtleties of the Dhammas, you know, leading up to the Four Noble Truths, and particularly the third and fourth one of the peace, of liberation, even the momentary peace, just those moments where there's no wanting in the mind, no fear or anger, and where delusion is not at that moment arising and clouding our vision. So in that way, we can see a kind of progression. in some ways, in some traditions, it's followed that way. But the truth of the matter is, most of us experience Satipatthana as it should be experienced. And that is, we're just present, as the word, the translated word sati means, presence, for whatever is arising. And in fact, all these things arise all the time, each moment. There's sensation, feelings, of course, mind, and dhammas, the experience of the mind. They are all arising in every moment. Some traditions emphasize body, or emphasize feelings, or emphasize just mind in the beginning. And some emphasize it the entire time, you know, to completely know the body. You come to know its inner relationship with the mind. Physical sensations have a causative effect on the mind. You know, you feel pain in the body, and there's a response in the mind of unpleasantness or aversion. If we're really mindful, it can awaken the mind. We're just experiencing extreme heat element, you know, extreme air element. It's noticed as it is, and the mind becomes more awake, more soft, more aware, the heart more open for knowing that. We see the unpleasant nature of that, or the pleasant nature of the insight itself, and the experience as noticed as one of the aggregates or sense spheres, or the absence or presence of any hindrance or enlightenment factor, all there in the moment. Some traditions emphasize a balance of all four. Some traditions help each student individually find what works best for them. You know, which of these four foundations one should major in, and, you know, minor in the other ones. After, 25 years of doing the Mahasi tradition, and primarily through Upandita Sayadaw's style, I started to practice under the guidance of his late best friend, Shwe Umin Sayadaw, which is a completely different, I think I've mentioned it, totally different, no labeling, half-hour walks, tremendous emphasis on relaxation, being tension-free, being really open and accepting, compassionate to all mind states, phenomena, whatever comes up, without the attitude of, you know, getting rid of anything, the bad guys and getting the good guys, you know, to come up. Just really an openness to all of that. And using primarily awareness of awareness, the mind watching the mind, following the flow of knowings rather than objects. And here too, it's really encompasses all four foundations. If you're really watching the flow of mind, you see the knowing of sensations. You feel the knowing of sensations. You feel the knowing of feelings. You feel the mind stream and all the mental states. And you feel the awareness of all the dhammas, hindrances, awakening factors, sense spheres, the aggregates of our being, the Four Noble Truths. And I think that's, I think the healthiest way is, you know, to not have any formulaic attitude about how to do the practice. Learn as much as you can. It all really rests on the moment and on mindfulness. And the greatest power of satipatthana is present, is its present time awareness, attending to the present moment, the presence of mindfulness. If you're present, Nothing in the world disturbs the mind. No matter how alluring and tempting and beautiful, no matter how repulsive, difficult, stressful, anguishing. For in the present moment, we can hold that and be equanimous. When we're not in the present moment, you know, then we feel dukkha, or we get duked out, we get caught up in it. You know, as soon as we start conceptualizing our experience, we're not in the present moment. When we have thoughts about, oh, this is good practice, I'm in the present moment, we've just kicked ourselves out of the present moment. And, you know, if we're attached to the subtle good states that we feel and start doing whatever manipulative tricks to keep it or get it back, we're out of the moment. And we're really training the mind to distance itself from staying in the present. I've mentioned a number of times that the subtlety and beauty of Dhamma is that our heart, mind, our experience has its own innate, pure desire to liberate, to purify and liberate. You know, really left alone, it does it itself. The mind is Dhamma. The heart is Dhamma. And we just put ourselves in a condition here of silence, of sila, of samadhi, quieting the mind, the stillness, the courage, confidence it takes, you know, work some of these mind states with the inspiration from hearing the Dhamma, but it's still the Dhamma doing itself. We get caught up into thinking, I'm doing this, you know. Stephen said to do this. Oh, yeah, but Michelle said to do that, and Susan said this, and Myoshin said. In the end, the voice we listen to is the clearest of all. You know, the Buddhist teachings of the Dhamma. And the Dhamma is within. It has its own agenda, its own timetable. We can't push it. We can't rush it. We get caught up often in, I want more, or I want faster. Now, this isn't good enough. You know, how do I keep this? How do I push through this? And those are all little ways that we lose that presence. There are all ways we've been trained, you know. There must be something more to do. One of the things I would hear Sayadaw say the most, observing him work with hundreds and hundreds of yogis, was, don't want more. Why do you want more? Lighten up and rest back in the current of the Dhamma. Let it carry you. We live in a more culture, you know, so it's just conditions. There's no blame. Nothing wrong with us. Of course, we hold that vision. We hold the vision of island in mind. We hold the vision of liberation in mind. But if we're attached to it, you know, if we push too hard, if we put up the big sails and we should have the storm sails, our practice becomes paralyzed. The process becomes blocked. We're really interfering with nature. Dhamma is nature. It's another meaning of Dhamma, nature, universal nature. So all our Dhamma talks and the advices that we offer in interviews and so forth, we're just trying to initiate a process in your own heart. And then once that happens, then our job is to tell you, leave it alone. Let it work itself. Stop pushing. You know, notice that wanting. Notice that You know, it's not good or not good enough. Those are conditions too. And again, we have to go into the dukkha nature of things. Wanting is the second noble truth. The ignorance and craving of the second noble truth are the cause of dukkha. When we want a lot, we dukkha a lot. When we want less, we dukkha less. When we want nothing, there's no dukkha. It's really important to explore that relationship of wanting and dukkha. The Buddha said, not knowing dukkha is dukkha. Knowing dukkha is liberation. To explore wanting, wanting is dukkha. Wanting is not a contenting mind state, contented mind state. It's not in the moment. It's grasping for more, no matter what it is. And the subtler our practice gets, the subtler our craving and wanting gets. It gets very subtle. It gets almost saintly subtle. Real refined levels of being so equanimous and so in the present moment, so at peace with things as they are, all mental formations, you know, a perfect equanimity. Just like on the edge of touching the unconditioned, the unborn, the deathless, Nibbana. And the slightest wish, the slightest impulse can keep us from it for years, lifetimes. So we come to trust the innate restorative inclination of the mind, of Dhamma, to rest in its own stillness and to do its own work, have its own timetable. As I've said to a number of you who have come here, you know, this is already the whatever, you know, 10th day, and I've done lots of 10-day retreats, and it feels like I'm just starting. Why is that? I'll tell you why that is. Because the Dhamma in our hearts, the wisdom in our hearts, it knows how long we're here for. It knows we're here for 6 weeks or 3 months. And so it's going to develop all the aspects, all the qualities accordingly. And so we surrender to that. We trust that. It's smarter than we are, believe me. We open to our own dukkha, not by forcing, certainly not by talking ourselves into it. You know, we spend a lot of time, as Michelle has said, working all these strategies, survival strategies, protective measures, with denial, suppression, avoidance, distraction, intellectualization, you know, all as ways of not feeling dukkha. Even some of the meditation practices, which are for serenity, we use them to feel happy and peaceful, not to go into dukkha and to feel dukkha. Life is dukkha. Life is difficult. It's stressful. If we want to untangle that tangle of wanting, craving, and dukkha, we have to know them with a totally open mind and heart, without resistance, with the great courage. And starting with our bodies is as good as any place to start. We get good at working with the unpleasant in our bodies, then we already have a basis for working with more difficult states. Emotional stress, anxiety, difficulty. We're sitting, something suddenly triggers a memory, something we see in the present moment, in a story, a whole fantasy develops instantly, and we're completely caught up in envy or jealousy. As long as we obsess about the story, the narrative, you might as well just be envy and jealous for a while. If we let go of the story and feel the feelings, just jealousy, just envy, just dissatisfaction, the Dhamma is going to take you deeper. It's going to take you to deeper layers. Often behind those particular mental states, for example, are issues of low self-esteem, feelings of inadequacy, low self-worth. And that just kickstarts a process in which some current scenario that we are imagining seems to be the problem. But the nature of the Dhamma and of pre-verbal awareness is to take us way, way, way in there to domains in our consciousness that have no story. You know, where these energies are imprinted on us, these feelings of inadequacy, anxiety. They're karmic formations or early life formations, childhood, youth, whatever. But they can imprint themselves before we even have the ability to conceptualize what they are. They can only be felt through this presence, mindfulness, because it's pre-verbal. Only pre-verbal can feel the non-verbal energies of our experience. And feeling is healing. Mindful, compassionate feeling is healing. Feel the pain, you know, to the extent that we can take it when we see that it's taking our energy, or we feel that we're being washed over by a tsunami, you know, tidal wave, or sucked into a black hole. We want to learn long before that happens, you know, how to back off. We want to learn to feel the edges and corners of when that's about to happen. So that we develop a strategy of grounding someplace that's safe. And what is it for you, you know? The visual sense of connection with the environment, sounds, whatever anchor, whatever present time experience that keeps you from leaving the present moment and keeps you from conceptualizing. You only want to conceptualize if there's nothing else to do. And for that, it's usually best, you know, to go to a teacher and have contact. But usually if we ourselves try to conceptualize what's happening, we just fuel the stuckness, you know, or being sucked into the black hole. We go deep, we touch it, like getting a homeopathic dose, we back off. The Dhamma increases our courage, our compassion, our capacity. We can feel more dukkha. Push the envelope on it and feel more. Until we feel that we're being led by the Dhamma. You know, there's nothing to do. It's just doing itself. Sayadaw used to say, you know, and I'd give a report, and he'd say, doesn't it feel like the Dhamma is massaging you from inside? And yeah, it was exactly how it felt. Whether it was pleasant or unpleasant, you know, there was a purification massage going on. And that's what we can hold. You know, these poems, we can make a shelter. We can hold the sense of loss, of change and loss, which is what life is. Whatever arises passes away. Whatever is born ages, decays, and dies. It's the way it is. And we can hold that and feel that, grieve that with mindfulness, especially those deep and early held karmic knots. That's where we begin to feel like we take a real breath. That's where we begin to feel that's why we're here, where we take delight and feel a healthy, selfless pride in this work. And rather than envious and jealous, we feel an empathetic joy for everyone else around us. We want them to be free of suffering too. And we just feel this mutuality, interconnectedness. I'd like to close with a true story at a center near where Michelle and I have been teaching for many years in Upper Burma. It's an area where there's, I think I've mentioned, people have been practicing for 2,000 years, first just in caves. It was very remote in the forest. It's still sort of remote. But now there's about 700 monasteries, 7,000-8,000 nuns and monks. And it's all living Dhamma, all practicing, studying. About 20 minutes walk from our center, which is on the east shore of the Irrawaddy River, in the side, the mountains, these rolling mountains, these hundreds of monasteries, thousands of pagodas, temples, just growing like trees, really inspiring. There's this valley called Parakama, and one side of the valley, the other side of the valley is called Parakama East, Parakama West. That monastery has also been there for many, many, many centuries. And I think it was in the mid-1800s, each one was occupied by a single ascetic. By the word, the Pali word that means ascetic, means the true meaning of being an ascetic is being a mental ascetic. You know, learning how to renounce mentally so that we can do this practice. And really, it's just another word of how to use our mindfulness to shed resistance, to shed whatever obstructs our work. So these two ascetic monks, who really love each other, they're really dear friends, they vow to practice until they're fully enlightened. And so one is in his cave and the other in his cave across the valley. And they are in a cave in the hot season and in these kutis, meditation cottages, in the cool season. And they say, well, I want you to be enlightened. When you're fully enlightened, they said to each other, please light a lantern so I can see it from across the valley and feel the mudita, the joy, the empathetic joy that you have attained. And they each agreed to do that. And they practiced for many, many, many years. And then one night, a moonless night, both out doing walking meditation, and the monk from the East Parakama Monastery looked across the West Parakama Monastery and he saw a light. And he saw the light and he knew his brother monk had become fully enlightened and felt such overwhelming empathetic joy. And then he noticed the joy in his mind arise and pass away. And in that moment, he became fully enlightened. And he lit his lantern. Keep the vision of the island in mind. Stay in the present. Let's sit in silence a moment.